It's our final scenery. It's nice to see a good crowd at this time, and it's great, that's great. The rest, of course, are combining work with tourism. Finally, we've been blessed with good weather, actually. But today's final talk is by Dr. Isabel Kaleya from the Department of International Relations and the Faculty of Arts, University of Malta. Now, Dr. Kaleya has been doing research in conjunction with the London School of Economics, am I correct?
Yes.
University of London, in Cyprus. And she's concerned with the whole issue of conflict resolution, I was going to say revolution, resolution in Cyprus. So, without further ado, I hand over to Dr. Kaleya.
Thank you, Peter. Before I start this paper, and in fact, if I go to the abstract, this paper is going to be arguing that the interpretation of history in Cyprus has been largely determined by the changing demand of external interests, and that this in turn illustrates that educational usages and methodologies in the teaching of history are often tied to changing parameters and practices of international relations, practice and theory. Now, before I start talking about this paper, I would like to clarify a few things. First of all, I want to make it clear, I think this is very evident, that I'm talking as an outsider, yes, in the context of the Cypriot issue. Obviously, as an outsider, this gives me certain advantages, but it also gives me a large number of disadvantages, including the fact that, of course, I am not conversant with the languages of Cyprus. I neither know Greek nor Turkish. And so, therefore, I have come to this issue primarily through English sources. Fortunately, there are a large number of them, but still, of course, there is a bias in looking at these English sources, and, of course, the discourse is particularly formatted in a particular way when you are looking at these sources. If nothing else, since they are English sources, then, of course, these sources are very related to academic material, newspaper material, official government material released on the international scene, and so obviously the focus is there. So obviously, as a consequence of this, I will apologize for any shortcomings due to these disadvantages. Now, a country's history is a nation's soul. And in fact, Hobsbawm tells us that nations without a past are contradiction in terms, that what makes a nation is the past, what justifies one nation against others is the past, and that historians are the people who produce it. And Kizil Yurek, writing on Cyprus, expresses similar sentiments. He tells us, the cult of historiography and the cult of nation are not separate, and that the first is used to create the second and legitimize the nation through the community of myths. It is in these historical myths, he adds, that we find the past, the present, and the future of the nation. Now, if we look at the history books that encompass all of Cyprus, and to a large extent, of course, these history books again tend to be of an academic content and tend to be written in English, and to a greater extent it's school textbooks. Now again, I came to these school textbooks through the critiques, because obviously the school textbooks are again in Turkish and in Greek, so I came to an understanding of what they dealt with by reading the critiques on these textbooks made by Greek Cypriot and Turkish Cypriot teachers. So obviously I will be enunciating their own concerns. From this material, therefore, Eric Hobsbawm's truth seems to be well illustrated in the case of Cyprus. For a nation's textbooks, and if we refer to Erickson in Memory, History and National Identity, are the vehicle par excellence to reflect and transmit the national memory, which is illustrated through this community of myth. Thus, it comes as no surprise that there is no such thing as a history textbook on Cyprus that details the exploits, the history, the national memory, and the corollary myths of a Cypriot nation. For such a nation does not exist. Indeed, if we were to use Hobsbawm's and Kildjurek's statements as yardsticks to evaluate the state of Cyprus, then we would have to argue that Cyprus is as yet, as a whole island, a state in the making, and that these important attributes of nationhood need to be created. Now, Cypriot history textbooks in English vernacular are numerous, for the island has been used as case material for studies on conflict resolution, on ethnicity, on UN studies, on EU studies, small state studies, islands, colonialism, empire building. And it is in fact this quantity that in itself illustrates more poignantly that vacuum while detailing the story of Cyprus. For if we go to these books, now, and here I've got a map of Cyprus, and I will be explaining to you why its location is so important in understanding the portrayal of Cyprus within history textbooks, and of course the role of external elites in this portrayal. If we go to these textbooks, they convey historical reality of an island that has been constantly exposed to the vagaries of the international scene, and its history and social development closely linked and largely dependent on external conditions. An island where external players were paramount in establishing the main contours of identity, cultural, linguistic, and religious. The colonizers reinforcing their control and extending their influence by tapping into the establishment and attempting to reinvent the island's identity in their own image. The key variable in understanding this history is that of location. The island is found at a superb strategic site at the tip of the Mediterranean, where three continents meet. It has been annexed by every regional empire, and of course here in Malta we understand this very clearly, in order to provide for their strategic needs. It has fallen under the sovereignty of the Greeks, Phoenicians, Romans, Byzantine, Normans, Venetians. It has sustained a period under Islamic rule, and as a result has had its European and Christian cultures tempered by Muslimic and Arab-Turkish interface. A sense of heterogeneous island identity was therefore diffused by the constant exposure to external influences. The island population, by the beginning of the 19th century, consisted of a Greek ethnic majority and a Turkish ethnic minority that practiced different religions, spoke different languages, and adhered to different cultural practices. When nationalist aspirations were in full force in 19th century Europe, a unified sense of national identity around a common heritage and history did not develop yet. The inhabitants of Cyprus continued to consider themselves Greek and Turk rather than Cypriot. To date, Cypriot history textbooks that can be accessed by the entire Cypriot population and thus are in English continue to illustrate graphically this example. For instance, if we read Todd's 1991 on Cyprus, it tries to bring the Greek and Turkish Cypriots together in this book and illustrate it's meant to be new illustrations of Cyprus. However, the way it's done is that, of course, the Greeks deal with Greek considerations, the Turks deal with Turkish considerations. If we look at the need for new perspectives by Christophe Delon, Inside the Cypriot Miracle, Labors of an Embattled Mini-Economy, the same concerns are shown here. This book attempts to give a history of Cyprus through the economy of Cyprus. It does a very good job. However, basically what it does is it tends to ignore the Turkish aspect of the economy of Cyprus. Basically, reflecting these concerns, the textbooks of Cyprus detail basically the exploits of Greek and Turkish communities within the content of the folk memory and national myths of Greek and Turkish history. For history books, and even more a country textbook, all too often adopt a dialectic that reflects the needs, the doctrines, and the agendas of the ruling elite. These elites were to be found in Greece and Turkey, for Cyprus attained a Cold War independence in 1960. Crucial to Greek, Turkish, American, Soviet, and British interests, Greece and Turkey, NATO members, ensured the continued dependence on the island. It granted it a paper constitution. It derailed UN efforts in the 1960s that furthered conflict resolution, and it blocked the push towards a sovereign, independent Cyprus, reflected in Makarios' politics of the early 1970s. The fact was that the continued politics of Taksim and Enosis was essential in ensuring the Cold War regional politics of realpolitik. This dictated that there was to be no Cyprus, but only an island inhabited by the forces of two neighboring regimes. The history textbooks of Cyprus, therefore, in line with the demands of the foreign elite, do not promote a single nation, but rather that of two external nations. In this discourse, there is no space for a Cypriot national identity, for this would challenge the separate Greek and Turkish identities, which remain paramount for Greece and Turkey. Consequently, a post-colonial critique, which calls for historical acts of remembering, I would like here to maybe stop and we can have a quick look at the symbols of Cyprus. Yes, these are pictures taken of the northern part of Cyprus, where you have Welcome to the Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus on the left, and on the right you have the Turkish flag flying in north of Cyprus. The next picture shows basically, we see this here, the actual flag of Cyprus. There was a lot of debate over creating this flag and finding colors that were neutral and were not incorporated in either the Greek or Turkish flag. Eventually, they came out with these neutral colors of yellow and white and green. But if you notice, underlying, this is a fairly recent picture, underlying it is the Greek flag. This picture is taken post EU membership. And here I quote from Kostas Konstantinou. He says, Ralph Denktash's terrible aphorism that only the island donkeys are genuine Cypriots creates national caricatures, but sadly also captures a legal reality. Okay, so consequently, a post-colonial discourse which calls for historical acts of remembering in order to call up and understand the full dimensions of a country's historic history remains absent. But as Young tells us in his introduction to post-colonialism, an understanding of suffering, of identity, comes through the knowledge and acceptance of one's national history. And he tells us that these narratives are important vehicles on which we legitimize the new national state. However, the history of Cyprus is not written with the aim of conferring legitimacy on the Cypriot nation, but rather with legitimizing the claims of the island over Greece and Turkey. For Cyprus is the case par excellence of the seizures inherent in the Balkanization of Europe that has continuously threatened regional stability and today still represents in miniature the main international relations cleavages, awaiting to tear our present global system apart. Central Europe through the centuries has been home to large numbers of fledgling small states, all seeking to legitimize sovereign status against the background of contending big powers, intent on continued hegemony in the region. This David and Goliath scenario is further complicated by a mosaic of relations in the region that include multiple ethnic origins and languages, different cultural ambits of Greek, Roman, Turkish, and Russian origins, and a mixture of religious affiliations that include Catholic, Orthodox, Protestant, and Islamic strains, often all present in a single state. These states seek internal unity and external validation, as borders were often indeterminate realities. But these differences that are found in these states in the Balkan region are often polarized and utilized by the local hegemons. In this scenario, of course, then, recounting the history of these nations and producing coherent school textbooks becomes of supreme importance to both internal and external players. What type of national history, what type of national identity, what type of historical awareness is to be promoted? For it is the school history books, as Soyana Vek tells us, that are amongst the most important means for shaping national identity and historical awareness. Owing to them, pupils are at an early stage imbued with images of their own nation, its place in history, its characteristics, as well as with the images of other neighboring peoples. This fact indeed gives history teaching a special mission, which surpasses its educational task and turns it into an important instrument of both state and international policy. Indeed, history textbooks and the versions of History They Relate have long been recognized as crucial instruments in establishing local, regional, and global identity, and the impact they may have on the relations within and between states. Post-World War I, the revision of history school textbooks was seen as part of an important movement to reduce aggressive nationalism and promote peace. Post-World War II, efforts to reconcile warring nations was reflected in UNESCO's program of bilateral consultations between countries for the improvement of history textbooks. This task set that of eradicating a truth that stopped the national frontiers and adopted one that reflected an international context. In other words, it tried to allow countries like Germany and France to work on versions of history that they could both live with and that they could both utilize for the purposes of reconciliation and integration. However, regional players in this scenario may also utilize a human being's inherent need to have not only allies, but also enemies. And Ozelek, 2005, in his Psychological Approaches to the Cyprus Conflict, explains this by telling us that these texts can also, history can also encourage the creation of appropriate stereotypes in national history school texts. This method is conjoined with the inherent need of individuals to maintain borders and to preserve identity from contamination with enemy images. These psychological mechanisms are thus utilized to help maintain separate group identities. When two ethnic groups live side by side, as in Cyprus, their impact is to make them become increasingly resistant to acknowledging likeness and rather focus or create differences. In times of peace, these differences are exhibited, he tells us, through dress, dance, speech patterns, and the like. In times of hostility, however, these minor differences assume a major emotional importance. This psychodynamic process that affects the formation of psychological borders between two groups is then maintained and illustrated in the history textbook through the concept of the chosen traumas and glories. There are numerous studies basically illustrating the use of history textbooks as political tools in Cyprus. The theoretical bias here of these works is basically that of a post-colonial discourse centered on the notion of counter-narratives, of absolutism, constructed by the natives, basically upholding an insular version of homeland. In other words, in the words of Hill or Collins, the insider-outsider debate, or the us and the other. However, as Stoller tells us, the oppositional binary is more complicated. In understanding Cyprus, and in understanding the history textbooks on Cyprus, what we need for a more accurate rendering is a discourse of complicit post-colonialism. In line with Mr. Anne Hodges, who postulates that complicit colonialism is becoming the literary dominant of post-colonialism, and in line with Side's famous work of 1978, where he tells us there is no such thing as disinterested knowledge. All knowledge is contaminated by the web of power. If we then look at this discourse in this light, and we also draw on international relations discourse in the context of realist methods, realized through cultural hegemony, then in this framework it would illustrate more accurately the influence that regional or adjacent hegemons may exert on history teaching of its client state. Research in this area, however, is of course complicated by the presence of a number of overlapping and intervening variables. It makes it more difficult to draw the line between what is influence, what is pressure, between what is complicit and what is oppositional post-colonial phases in a country's history. Undoubtedly, if, as Lowenthal states, history textbooks reflect a particular image society has of its past and indirectly how it imagines its future, then one would have to argue that until recently, the future, the two communities in Cyprus aspired to remain that of union with Greece and union with Turkey. However, the situation here is one more reminiscent of the chicken-egg dilemma. Education in Cyprus has long been sectarian. The production of separate textbooks for the two communities commenced in 1884 with the supply of textbooks from Turkey. In 1895, the education law introduced two separate boards of education, one Christian, one Muslim. To date, two separate groups of textbooks continue to be used, linked to different versions of Cypriot community history found in the north and south of the island. Many of these textbooks are produced in the motherland, others are produced locally. Whether these texts reinforce external hegemony or local aspirations of Enosis and Taksim remains disputable. It is difficult to draw the line between the two. Undoubtedly, however, Greek and Turkish claims to the island are illustrated in the hegemony that they exercise over the portrayal of key events in the two histories of the island. These become forms of mirrored versions of single events. For the historical discourses articulated by rival nationalisms typically operate as oppositional pairs. Thus, the texts from the North and South both emphasize a number of oppositional stereotypes. The first one is tied up with the all-important origins of the Cypriot settlement and how this is dealt with in Greek and Greek Cypriot, Turkish Cypriot textbooks. Lawrence Kolapis, a Greek Cypriot, in his analysis of Greek Cypriot history textbook, shows us how they lay emphasis on the Hellenization of the island in the 12th century BC and constructed an unbroken Hellenized continuity from that time up to the present. The Republic of Cyprus, he tells us, has been functioning since 1963 in educational and ideological matters as a second Greek nation state. Through the educational system, it has been receiving ideology and history, perception emanating from Athens for the ideological needs of the Greek state. On the other hand, in historical memory and communal national identity, the Turkish Cypriot case, we are told that Ottoman Turks are spoken of within Cypriot Turkish textbooks as almost a present-day nation, so close in time and space, so internal to the discourse of the communal identity. They were the ones who built mosques, bridges, water canals, open schools, constituted a model of good and fair governance on the island, and believed to have protected both the Muslims and the Christians from the larger evils of the Eastern Mediterranean. Their history on the island was hardly contested. The politics of successive Ottoman governors hardly questioned. The history that they presented was detailed and flawlessly smooth in its vivacity and in its stronger sense of reality than either the British colonial regime or of present-day Turkish Cypriot politics. This is tied up with the second oppositional stereotype that links the community's achievements in Cyprus to military and cultural exploits that are foreign rather than indigenous. This twofold process is found in Turkish and Greek textbooks, both imported and local. Turkish textbooks insist on a victorious military advance to the centuries, while Greek Cypriot textbooks emphasize cultural continuity and cultural achievement. Thus, the notions of origin, of continuity of national pride and identity, are attached to the presence of the outsider, the patron, diminishing the context of the indigenous people and the Cyprusness that they symbolize. The third oppositional stereotype revolves around certain key historical events, in Cyprus post-1960. These same events are described and interpreted in very different ways and with very different vocabulary, depending on the center of narration. December 1963 is one such event. This was the Akritas Plan, basically designed to end the new republic by quickly suppressing the Turkish Cypriot reaction to impose constitutional change before outside intervention could be mounted. The plan was triggered off by an incident that occurred during a bout of intensified searches. One of these, on 21st December 1963, resulted in the death of two Turkish Cypriots by Greek Cypriot auxiliary police force and sparked off intercommunal fighting. Rampant killing by both communities followed, although undoubtedly it was the Greek Cypriots that led the rampage. Here I'm referring to Public Record Office documents in London that document these events. The violence that ensued led to the total or partial destruction of 103 mixed villages and the displacement of a quarter, nearly 30,000, of total Turkish Cypriot community. After their departure, in Greek Cypriot texts, these events are at best characterized by omissions and silence. In Turkish Cypriot texts, this is a traumatic event that has been translated into emotional teaching. For Turkish Cypriots, this date, through the discourse of history teaching, is kept within the collective memory, as the community remembers the period as one of tyranny and victimization. Now, as a mirror of this, we have 1974. This is another key event. Between 72 and 74, conflict resolution in Cyprus seems possible, and an agreed formula was in the pipeline. This may well, certain texts argue, even Greek Cypriot texts, may have led to a unified Cypriot nation as a viable enterprise. However, conflict resolution was forestalled, and in 74, Greece invaded the island and initiated a coup that overthrew the government of Makarios. Within days, Turkey responded by invading the island, expropriating 34% of the land, and in 1975, Denktash declared the Turkish Federated State of Cyprus. The result was the division of Cyprus as we know it today. Now, in Turkish Cypriot textbooks, this event is seen as a happy end for the Turkish Cypriot community, which arrived in 1974 when Turkey undertakes a military intervention called the Peace Operation and divides Cyprus geographically into two. Thereafter, in the Turkish Cypriot textbooks, Turkish Cypriots are living happily in northern Cyprus. For the Greek Cypriots, which this event I skipped over because I have too much material, but it also displaced 180 Greek Cypriots, although they were not the only people that were displaced, of course, because there was a movement of people, both Greek and Turkish, from north to south and south to north. But it displaced about 180 Greek Cypriots, and also a number of people went missing. For the Greek Cypriots, in their textbooks, 1974 remains the date when everything went wrong in Cyprus. It is a traumatic period of unmentionable loss and betrayal. Now, these portrayals basically tie up with the didactic use of history textbooks as put to in Cyprus as a form of a balance sheet of history. They become mnemonic devices that build up a rhetoric of blame based on the objectification of the victim. The purpose, Zelia Gregorio tells us, is to create a displacement of the othering, the process by which, through shifts in position, any given group can be ignored, trivialized, rendered invisible and unheard, perceived as inconsequential, deauthorized or othered, threatening, while others are valorized. The purpose being to legitimize the position of the insider and at the same time not to facilitate the political recognition of the outsider. This nationalism in the history textbooks often also deploys racist and exclusionary discourse. This is illustrated in the stories told by the victims, expressing a sole view and making the multiplicity of vision impossible. In the service of this agenda, children, through their textbooks, are exposed to horrific caricatures of their neighbors living only meters away across the green line. They are not only the primary other, but also the occupiers, the invaders, the enemies. Texts use a discourse of highly loaded and emotional language, full of imagery that sustains a notion of us and them. They are the images of ruthless murderers and innocent victims. This polarizing of the self and other was pointed out by the head of the Turkish Cypriot Educational Planning and Program Development Department in 2004. In the Cyprus, I'm quoting from Cyprus Mail, our text, he tells us, encouraged the student to make enemies. In one part of a history textbook, it describes how Greek Cypriots gouged our eyes and filled our bodies with holes. This kind of language, as well as breeding hatred, can also cause lasting psychological damage to the young readers. In both communities, therefore, history texts become a political tool that disallow the use of an analytical methodology that would open the mind and enable understanding. For with this oppositional discourse, the stereotypes continue to propagate not only an inaccurate rendering of the relationship across the ethnic divide, but even within it. The textbooks invariably portray the conflicts as intercommunal ones, the 1963-64 one, the 1974 one. They do not touch on intracommunal conflicts, on conflicts within the communities themselves, within the Greek Cypriot community, those conflicts, or within the Turkish Cypriot community. They do not touch on conflicts between the client states and the mother countries, important variables in order to understand the 1964 Civil War and the 1974 invasions. Thus, the history textbooks reinforce the image of solidarity between patron and client states, with little mention of the relation of coercion and dependency between the two, while intercommunal relations are never mentioned other than in terms of conflict. School textbooks thus utilize the external at the expense of intercommunal harmony. However, the role of a uniform history in bringing Cyprus together has long been recognized, and there have been numerous discussions going on for a long time on producing joint history textbooks in Cyprus. Indeed, Mr. Rustem Tatar, former Auditor General of Cyprus, pointed out in a letter to the Cyprus Mail that in 1977, as early as 1977, he had brought to the attention of those participating in the intercommunal negotiations the need for history textbooks on Cyprus that created consensus. It is, however, only since the end of the Cold War that a real discourse has commenced. This once more is tied largely to external remit. Post-Cold War, we witness a new regionalization of Cyprus politics. This is the birth of a new Balkan region, no longer divided by a politics of bipolarity. It now provides space for the arrival of numerous small states. These states ensure the security and stability through eventual EU membership. Greece, a local hegemon in the region, is now an established member of the EU. Cyprus, this is at the end of the century, 1999, year 2000, in Cyprus membership is in the pipeline, as is the eventual start of accession negotiations for Turkey. In this new dynamic, the security and regional interests of Greece and Turkey now become complementary. Turkey is fully aware that without a resolution of Cyprus, membership is impossible. Greece is also fully cognizant that the answer to the riddle of Cyprus lies in Turkish membership. Both now acknowledge that once membership is granted to all three players, the problem of access and security of Cyprus becomes largely redundant, and both states would be better served if they could now shed this tiresome power keg. Thus, for the first time, the interests of both patron states are in line with those of the state of Cyprus, built around the notion of a Cypriot identity. In this new regional politics, a push towards a Cypriot identity politics is now encouraged by the most important regional player, the EU. For this organization, basically, reflects a shift in international politics from realist intergovernmental models based on a national discourse and bilateral methodologies towards more institutionalist, functionalist, and integrative approach based on multilateral mechanisms. Localized models based on multi-ethnic Cyprus identity now become feasible within the context of a federalized EU, and Cyprus's locality as a border member of the EU is now being articulated as an economic and political and cultural bridge. For what is happening here now, in this new globalized and regionalized climate, the need for communication and collaboration of these states in the Balkan region becomes imperative. External players acknowledge that the dynamic relationship between past and present affects not only how one understood and interpreted historical facts, but also how human actions would be determined in the present. And in this complex and highly introvert and conflictual character of education in the region now has to be addressed in order to foster an education of understanding. For regime breakdown in the Balkans cannot be allowed. It would be a dangerous imperative. And of course, it has already occurred in the EU's backyard in the cases of Kosovo and Bosnia. It had already been illustrated. So the EU has to find a politics that would obviously limit this. As a consequence of this, we start seeing new programs that are basically being sponsored by the international community, with the EU at the head of these programs, trying to sponsor a new type of history-making, especially in the context of history textbooks. In 1997, under the sponsorship of the Council of Europe, numerous associations from different Balkan nations come together to initiate a school of historical revisionism that would allow the new states to cohabit adjacent and at times even shared spaces. Cypriot historians and teachers participate. Comparative research here is encouraged, related to the study of school curricula and textbooks. The dialectic here is that of peace studies, which basically promotes a history not of war, not of political grandeur or political contingency, but rather is seeking a history of those variables that are central to people's existence, and one that will bring them together rather than divide them. In other words, there is a search now for a history of environment, a history of economics, a social history, a history of different mentalities and different cultures. The basic dialectic is that of the Anal school. Okay, so this workbook project is also a recent manifestation of the aim of the EU, basically, to encourage and support reconciliation in the region by allowing the children, basically, to view the area's shared history from many points of view. In other words, trying to introduce a form of innovative pedagogy. Projects that are basically being sponsored by the Council of Europe focus specifically on Cyprus in July 2003, where with the initiative of the Secretary General and with the agreement of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of the Republic of Cyprus, a new project is started. And in 2004, the Council organizes four activities, which brought together basically participants across the divide, and again the focus was on teaching history as multiple, as multi-perspectivity. Further projects have also been suggested and recommended again through the EU, and this was the Reconciliation Commission. The Commission was established to promote understanding, tolerance and respect between Greek and Turkish Cypriots in the light of the Annan Plan, which was also being pushed and promoted by the EU, and it was meant to take place just before EU membership. The work, again, was to include the promotion of dialogue between Greek Cypriots and Turkish Cypriots regarding the past, and to prepare a comprehensive report on the history of the Cyprus problem, as experienced by both Greek and Turkish Cypriots. So, in other words, what is happening here now is that in the history of Cyprus, it is still an external player that is attempting to formulate this history. The influence of Greece and Turkey is now being replaced by that of the EU, which now sees a history which in turn would legitimize and to an extent even mythologize its role both within Cyprus and the region, a new community history that would be shaped around the discourse of supranationalism. This discourse would focus on a pedagogy of history that looked at the grand project of Europe and would offset and discourage major historical narratives, ethnocentric or even narrowly nationalistic. In effect, what we have here is the making of a new normative and institutional memory of the new past, which codifies and homogenizes the collective memory in the context of the needs of the new external player, the EU, which requires a united Cyprus. Thus, Cyprus starts in its historiography a new journey. And Dr. Zagai Ozalik tells us that it is necessary to deal with the historical and psychological barriers to achieve lasting and perpetual peace. And thus, schools of historians have to start analyzing the conceptualization of differences, externalizations, projections, traumas, glories, dehumanizations, and so on and so forth, in order to create a greater understanding of the historical, psychological, and political barriers between Turkish and Greek Cypriots. And We've seen a number of projects as well between Across the Green Line in a bicommunal seminar in Ledra Palace in 2004. The bicommunal teaching training center hosted History, How Do We Teach It? How Should It Be Taught? With the support of the Fulbright Commission. And here, Dimitris Tousasis, a 17-year-old student, was commenting on the textbooks in the Greek Cypriot region, and he asked, why does so much blind that hatred exist among his Greek Cypriot peers, none of whom were ever born at the time of the invasion? He laid the guilt for this prejudice on a politicized education system that demonizes one side and naively praises the other. In the same year, the head of the Turkish Cypriot Education Planning and Programming Department, Dr. Hasan Eti, made history with a project that aimed to bring sweeping changes to the way history is taught in Turkish schools. He started creating a syllabus that would give an objective view of history. And again, we have other projects. In 2008, a new one has just started. I think it was referred to just a little bit earlier, an association lifelong program inaugurated under the EU. But to cut the long story short, how are these projects basically impacting on the presentation of these textbooks? Well, if we look at Cyprus today, Cyprus remains a two-state solution. It is not a unified Cyprus. As we know, the Annan Plan foundered, and the north of Cyprus remains excluded from the EU, although from 2003 onwards, barriers have gone down. There has been a lot of economic interchange. A lot of northern Cypriots have also taken on passports of the Republic of Cyprus. So there has definitely been movement. But however, the struggle continues. And these setbacks are reflected in the continued struggle to frame a unitary vision of the Cypriot state. Gregorius, in 2004 article, explains that though there are efforts to create new textbooks that would give a less impassioned, more objective view of what went on in Cyprus and to try to create a discourse of basically a Cypriot nation, they are constantly being countered by problems. So in 2002, a textbook that came out, The Modern and Contemporary World, 1815-2000, for the third grade lyceum, was published by the Organization for the Publication of Textbooks. This textbook depicted EOKA as a socialist super-conservative nationalism, and the book was attacked for belittling the memory of national heroes, i.e. EOKA, and provoked the reaction of the Cypriot Minister of Education. The Cyprus Mail in 2007 recounts how a new history textbook for 11-year-olds also ignited the wrath of clergymen and nationalists. In this, the textbook's revisionist views of the Greek War of Independence against the Ottoman Empire was condemned and was seen as unpatriotic. The Socialist Unity, a newspaper as recent as March 2008, stated that educational reform is indeed linked to reunification. Changing how society views itself, however, starts with the education of the young. Most of the textbooks produced in the island, in the humanities and social sciences, especially in the history textbooks, give a distorted picture of Cypriot parts. So, this situation to date may be on the road towards amelioration, but it has not been completed. And, of course, one of the reasons for this is that in Cyprus today, forces remain that view the island's politics and history within a constricted vision of narrow communal interests. Although, interestingly enough, today, of course, we heard the case study, right, of the monuments, right, of Cyprus, and trying to explain the two, the area, the enclave, right, where there has been Greek and Turkish Cypriots, and trying to resurrect the history of Turkish Cypriot presence there. So this type of history is in the making. There also seems to be general agreement that education plays a crucial role in furthering reconciliation. And there is general agreement that Cyprus needs textbooks that teach diversity and tolerance, that teach children how to coexist in multicultural and multi-ethnic societies, that teach children that there is no one truth in history, that history generates conflict. The ideas offer cover the conflict. It is imperative that they know about the conflict, but that they understand, they learn to understand the conflict and the reasons for the conflict. There is also a general acknowledgement that peace education, conjoined with a Galtungian philosophy of conflict resolution, needs to become the current coinage within the teaching of history. However, the case of Cyprus also illustrates the gap that exists between theoretical models and their practical application. For the former, often tells us little about the latter. In this case, though there are numerous discourses on what should be done, there is little on telling us how it should be done. What cultural models will be adopted? Will they include all the minorities? For instance, what is the place of the Armenians? What is the place in this new history of the new Turkish community that settled in recent years, post-1974, and which to this day there is still a lot of discord over? What language or languages will the textbooks be in? Will they be in Greek? Will they be in Greek and Turkish? Will they be in Greek, Turkish and English? Will these numerous languages be sustainable? What sources will be cited? Will they cite Greek sources, Turkish, both English sources, and how will this history be taught? Will it be taught in co-education schools? And I think there are a few in Cyprus that do so. Will the production of textbooks continue to be completely state-dominated? And if the onus for change continues to come from external players, will this affect the pace of change? These are questions that are being asked in Cyprus today, and obviously, as yet, the answers are unclear. However, in the final analysis, there is a growing recognition that in Cyprus, a space needs to be created for historians to write a history of Cyprus that is not tied to specific interests, internal or external, but allows the text to reflect a multiple and sophisticated layering of history. Through these texts will emerge a cacophony of voices, the voices of the Cypriots, a voice of Cyprus. Four, Cyprus needs a common past in order that it can have a common future. And today, under the new post-Cold War scenario, this space has opened up and this enterprise has become feasible and possible. Thank you. Any questions?
I was just wondering whether there is any mention in the history books of Cyprus of the role, of the vital role played by the British and the Americans in the in Cypriot recent history, and their role in the conflict, because from what I understand, their role was not marginal; it was fundamental. And also, whether there's any reference in recent history on both sides to the fact that there are military bases of these two powers.
Well, in the history books of Cyprus generally, yes. In fact, external players play an extremely important part, and a lot of the history books that are written on Cyprus in the English vernacular, of course, focus very much on the role of external players and on the role of external players in creating the present situation in Cyprus. And this, of course, includes the continued location of the two bases there. In the context of the actual textbooks I have to make clear that my knowledge is limited, but from what I've read through, obviously, other papers, this is a period that tends to be shortened within the actual school textbooks. I mean, the periods are there, yes, obviously, the British colonial heritage is there, but it is not given the due importance it should be given in terms of the time, yes, and the actual events that took place. But please correct me. There are many Greek Cypriots in this room, so, no.
I mean, it's hard to feel the burden to be a spokesperson for your place of authority. I mean, it's a big problem, like when you send a paper and it's about Cyprus, and in any journal, and they write back, well, write a paragraph about the background. And if it's a paper about voucher system, for example, in the States, you don't need a page about the background. So it's nice that there are other people doing work on Cyprus. So, I mean, it's taking away the burden from the natives to behave like natives. So in a way, I'm not an I mean, in such a kind of approach, there are no expert positions. But as an expert on Foucault, not an expert on Cyprus, one of the things that I find to be missing from the textbooks, there are many references to colonial power. However, references are always in a kind of this religious discourse, you know, this orthodoxy. Like, we all knew how the British used the divide and rule method. Okay? So that makes it so easy to demonize the British and not show that colonial power was able to be very effective because it was always already interlocking with local kinds of power, and that is not shown in the textbooks.
I was wondering, what does this tell us in Malta about our own history? Of course, we do not have the kind of traumatic recent past that Cyprus has had in terms of an actual division, although some say we were close in some cases. But there is definitely, at least that's how I see it, two concurrent histories about key aspects of our recent past. At least I see this very much in our own reality, in Maltese reality. Definitely when you look post-war, let's put it this way, post-Second World War. And I'm wondering what this is telling us. I wonder if this is telling us in Malta that if we don't look at our own history, or if we don't try to come to terms with these different histories, we shall not be a nation? Is that what you're saying? Or we are not a nation? Or I'm saying this because I have there seems to be a tendency to try and live and let live with the fact that for many, many people in Malta, this chunk of, you know, this 40, 50 year chunk of history in our contemporary past has two different narratives. And there seems to be the idea it's better to live and let live and just let the past be and let's try and start something anew. And I'm wondering whether that's possible at all.
There does tend to be a hesitancy to deal with certain aspects of our history, and ironically, this affected me personally, because in my doctoral study, part of what I dealt with conflict in Cyprus, and I dealt with conflict in Malta, and therefore part of the conflict I dealt with was the period, you know, from the 1950s right up to the present. So it dealt with key areas of conflict, for instance, the 1960s, and again the late 70s and the early 80s. And when I started on this work, I was told by just one or two people, listen, do you really want to do this? Are you sure you would like to focus on this area? Don't you think you are resurrecting a discourse of conflict that we don't need? And I was told, this is a biggest paper I have written today. A friend of mine wrote it, and he told me, but listen, by writing this paper, you are not doing any good. All you are doing is resurrecting a conflict, you know, rather than on trying to find, you know, variables that bring it together. So you are, in fact, trying to, you know, extend this discourse of conflict. In answer to your question where you say, does that mean that we have no nationalism? I mean, there have been different interpretations of this way of recounting our history. I mean, someone like Peter Terracino and Gloss would tell you, listen, or Maria Milani would tell you, listen, they believe in the notion of two nations in Malta, yes? And of course, this was not unusual. In all of southern Europe, there was a discourse. If there are any forced Portuguese or Greeks here or Spanish, they would tell you there was a discourse of Spaniards, two Spanish, two Greeks, you know. The left-right cleavage was not just you know, a permanent factor in Malta. Then, I mean, there are people like Oscar Balbacino, who has an article in Western European Politics which calls the nation the state. It says, listen, we don't have a nation. What we have are two moral ethnics. And he looks at it in terms of the Conservatives, the Nationalists, and the Labour Party. So there are many ways of interpreting this division. I prefer the first interpretation, that there is, you know, two, as you said yourself, that basically we are a split nation, a notion of two nations, you know, and that these two nations basically replicate two different historical forces as a matter of hegemony in order to support their own attachment to power and control. So, yes, I agree with you.
Thank you very much for your presentation, and I have no right question, maybe comment or to mention one similar situation, what we have in Bosnia and Herzegovina. Right now, from the 96 when the war was stopped, with the Dayton Peace Accord, we have a 12 years three different history books, or three different history curricula and more textbooks, because now it's possible to have the same curricula, you know, few authors writing history. And thinking about, you know, that situation, what you presented about Cyprus, I think that is almost the same scenario, but it's going after one conflict is stopped, but with unfinished war goals, you know, and this is now a way of how to reach war goals in on a peaceful way, through the education and through the books. And so, was it some progressive authors and pedagogues? I'm not a historian, but I participated in some of these discussions. Shall we teach written history at all or not? But then we thought better to teach in a school officially than each family with their own traumas, you know, to influence children. But unfortunately, not much, we didn't get a more different situation, more official and more, I would say, objective education in a school. We had also one PhD student from Finland who did a PhD in studying three curricula in history from Bosnian Croatian side, Bosnian Muslim side, and Bosnian Serbian side. And somehow this Croatian and Bosniak or Muslim curricula are approaching, but Serbian is still, you know, they are explaining, each of them are explaining as aggression from other side and liberation from their own side is very difficult. I'm not very optimistic in the near future that we will get a kind of consensus of agreement what to teach students. And I'm thinking that it's good in academic conferences to talk about that example. Maybe we have more in Europe or in these areas, maybe not so obvious, similar situation, and we have to put them on a surface and discuss about that and talk and try to find and reach to common results or possible solutions on that. Thank you very much.
Just a short comment about Malta. I'm not sure about the two narratives of our two narratives. I'm not sure about that. I think slowly. Well, perhaps I'm an optimist in this sense, but I think there's a one perhaps all-encompassing narrative emerging slowly on Malta's recent past. And I'm thinking of a couple of books that have been written recently, like Perotta's book, for example, Perotta's two volumes. And also, the main political leaders seem to be coming to terms with the sins of the past, of the 60s and of the 80s. So I just wanted to make that comment. I think there is a difference between the two. There's an important difference between the two situations we're talking about here. Not, of course, with Bosnia, but between Cyprus and Malta.
I mean, even Cyprus has its own conflict of left and right. A very long historical conflict.
Well, to Max, I think, first of all, it's a problem with history textbooks in general. You know, history textbooks are like religious education, you know. It's like they're moralizing, they're not doing history. So, I mean, even if we have the right textbook, it's still very problematic. I mean, here the problematic is more visible because you have two narratives, so you can compare and you can see the differences. But it's a problem with the history discourse in general. When it comes to history textbooks, everybody has an opinion. You know, workers have opinion, housewives have opinion, nurses have opinion, presidents have opinion. Everybody has opinions. How do you teach history and what do you teach in history? But if you talk about science, they say, well, let's leave it to the experts. So, I mean, well, I'm not actually teaching historical thinking in school. We're just moralizing and producing national or post-national subjects. So now about the post-national subject I just said, I have expressed a very serious critique about these textbooks in my work. However, when I see these new textbooks coming out of these conflict resolution factories, I'm not sure if I prefer to have national subjects or if I prefer to have, you know, post-conflict global consumers who are all very happy and they love each other. So I think they're both very problematic.
Okay. Thank you very much for actually drawing the conference to a close with your keynote speech, which deals with one of the many conflict areas, we have to use that word, in which characterizes this region. The conflicts are many, not just Cyprus. We've just heard about Bosnia and others, in Turkey with the Kurdish situation, etc. Which makes, and this I'm going to conclude the conference here, as the new president of MEŞE, which makes our task very difficult in organizing projects like this. I am under no illusion that our work in the next 2 years, until we set up the next meeting, is going to be easy. We've encountered great difficulties this time, related to conflict, you know, who comes and who doesn't. As the prorector said on the first day, you know, the presence of X automatically means the absence of Y. This is one of the realities we are facing. And, you know, there's no, we can't, you know, push this aside or place it under the carpet. It's there. We face this whenever we try to create projects in this region. Now, I'm not going to give you another talk about what are the research agendas. We've heard a lot of that from the very first talk by Professor Sultana, and we've had this during the parallel sessions. Basically, what we can do from now onwards. Now, I'm new in this position, but one of the things I'm going to suggest is that I know this is problematic, because once you bring in information technology, you could automatically be excluding certain parts of the Mediterranean. But we must try. I know there are universities. We were in Alexandria, where we've used IT. Of course, we were in the Alexandrian Library. That was 2 years ago. And maybe one of the things we can do from now onwards, before we meet again, is to create a website. We had a website for the for the conference. That's how most of the submissions were made. And although we have to look at that carefully in terms of who gets left out. And we should have a website also to keep the whole thing active. And I'm suggesting that, it's a pity many of our international colleagues now are out exploring the islands of Malta and Gozo, I suppose. as is often the case on the afternoon of the last day of any conference. Okay, so because it would be interesting, for example, one of the activities could be using one of these three languages, Arabic, French, and English, if we can organize talks about research in one particular country, a particular aspect of educational research, and turn this into a webcast, which we can then place on the web, on the website, or alternatively into a podcast, where it's only the voice, which will be used. We can do this. We've had this done at our university with Campus FM, with regard to a number of activities, including the work in progress, seminar series, and others. I see no reason why we can't do this also with Meshe, whereby, for example, our colleagues in Egypt could provide a talk, either in French, in Arabic, or in English, and they could send it to us as, I don't know if this is the right technical term, a webcast, so we can place it on, film it, and place it on the web so that everybody can access it. This is what the organizations like, I'm going to look up to the, so one of the external players now, Britain does, the Royal Society of Arts do this. They stream and then they put them on as a webcast. So I think we can take an idea, we can pick up that idea. So that's one of the things I would like to introduce during this 2-year period. Hopefully I'll come up with better ideas and we'll have more activities than simply this one. But this is just to get things started. I know you're tired after a second day's, whole day's work. And the other thing we have to think seriously about is the next venue. Now, the name, the idea of Rabat in Morocco has been floated around. We hope that happens. We have a letter from the dean, but I would like to see this happen. Unfortunately, I think this is I personally was quite satisfied with this particular conference. However, I was really impressed by some of the papers which were presented, and I think this is some of the impressions I gathered from from my colleagues and my friends. Of course, some people would say, okay, the level is uneven, but that's typical of most conferences. When you have this open conferences, the level will always be uneven. But I thought on the whole, we were more the papers were on the strong side, I would say. Actually, certainly the ones I listened to, save one or two. I thought we had some really good keynote presentations too. We had a very good international presentation. Of course, as always, I would always love to see a greater representation from the southern part of the Mediterranean. We tried our damnest with the resources we have here in Malta to try and make this possible. We even got the funds for an Arab scholar, but as you know, he did not turn up. So sometimes there are things beyond our control. And of course, I'm worried now with regard to the next venue. I mean, I'm make no bones about this. I mean, I'm worried about the next venue because the person concerned was supposed to organize the next conference. It would be important, I think, that we can have. It's important to try and get the conference back into an Arab country. We've had it in Alexandria before this. It was quite successful. We brought it to Europe this time, or on the periphery of Europe, if you like. And then I think we should alternate as far as possible. Of course, we'll be looking for a contingency just in case it doesn't happen in Morocco. We'll keep you informed about this. So this is one of the tasks, one of the immediate tasks we face. We have another task. We have to support Fatma Gok, who has the unenviable task now. Fatma Gok is not here. She's from Turkey, from the University of Boğaziçi University, the University of the Bosphorus in Istanbul, who has now the onerous task of organizing, just like Adila Prezo did last September, the World Congress of Comparative Education. So for two successive times, this Congress, this World Congress of Comparative Education, it brings about how many people? 300 people? 500 people? 800. 800 to 1,000 people. Converging on one city and a couple of hotels. This is, for the second time running, it's going to be held in this part of the world. So Meshe will be again involved, just like we were involved last time in Sarajevo, in terms of vetting papers, etc., for the various topics. And so we have to work closely with Adila in ensuring that the World Congress will be a success. And then I would not envisage that it will take place in the Mediterranean for the third time, because that would be asking too much. One other thing is that we have the emails of most of the people here, and also those outside,
of course, because they've all applied, etc., and corresponded with us. So we'll be contacting you now shortly with a form to offer you the possibility of becoming members of Meshe. Okay? So we have to agree on the price, because we have to negotiate certain things about what Meshe would entail. Might entail a journal, might not. We'll have to see that. And we'll be contacting you. I know we missed a great opportunity this time. Well, everybody was here, but you know, we had to juggle the finances of registering, so that could create a lot of confusion. And I don't think we had the support, you know, to be able to handle something beyond that. So that's as far as this conference goes. I would like to conclude, to bring this conference to a close, by first of all thanking you all for participating. You've been wonderful, not just you, but also those who are not here right now, with your participation, the questions you've been asking. I know we've been restricted in terms of time. We hope to do it better next time. We have to think in terms of an extra day, because there were too many papers, we have little time, and the questions were very, 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 very searching. Many of them were very searching. Maybe it was frustrating, you have only two or three questions. The other thing we have to do now is, I also want to thank not just you, but the people who have made this happen. Carmen, who's put so much into this, I can assure you. I would like to thank also the graduate students in the EMSER program, the Euro-Mediterranean Center for Education Research, spearheaded by Ronald. You all know him as Ronald, Professor Ronald Sultana. I also want to thank EMSER for also sponsoring the participation of two of our keynote speakers, Andrea Mazzawi and Zelia Gregoriou. And I also want to thank the University of Malta and the Istituto Italiano di Cultura for having sponsoring the presence amongst us of Professor Landry. I want to thank the Strickland Foundation for providing the funds to get for us to get an Arab scholar. Unfortunately, the person gave up the ghost. I don't know. He did not turn up. And I also want to thank the Education Department for sponsoring 13 to 15 teachers to participate in this at this conference. And you know, they sponsored them registration and everything. Which other organization have I left out? Oh, and then we have foreign, you see, we have external players too. But there might be Colonia, I'm not sure about that. One of them is Taylor and Francis. They've dominated all the publishing side, yes. They have been amongst our sponsors. That's why you got the flyers in the registration package. And also Sense Publishers from Holland. So I have to thank them also for their sponsorship of the part sponsorship of this event. And let me not forget also people who handle the technical side of things. Our good colleague Nigel Mallet and David Pisani. Without the support, this would not have functioned. And all the staff at the hotel here who made it a pleasant experience for those who while we enjoyed our coffee, our stay in this hotel. And also the various dinners, etc. And also, I'm sure the help that they gave to the various clients at this hotel, clients who were participants at this conference. So I bring this to a close. Thank you once again for coming.